So I've been interested for a very long time in problems concerning polymer adsorption, and our group has been doing a lot of work in homopolymer adsorption, which is a sort of hard problem to do theoretically and a tricky problem to handle experimentally. So what I'll tell you about today is the polyelectrolyte version of the story, and then also to go back, if there's time, to help provide some perspective, I'll go back and put some comparison in with the non-ionic system. So before I even get into the dynamic questions, because there are so many different regimes and different physics that you can encounter when you do polyelectrolytes, and when you do polyelectrolytes on surfaces, there's an even greater variability of specifics that one has to sort of define before you even know where you are in the grand scheme of things. I'm going to spend some time telling you about the details of the chemistry. The system we've chosen, because it is a very well-defined system, and while there are a lot of experimental studies in the literature on polyelectrolyte adsorption, and still quite a number on dynamics of polyelectrolyte adsorption, I don't think there are so many of these that have the details with respect to the charge density and the counterions as well-defined as we have, and it's been two PhD theses just to get the system characterized, in addition to get moving on looking at the dynamics. So it's the work of these two students, Yang Wuxin, who did most of the characterization, and Nan Thea, who's now finishing up the dynamics with me. The situation here is one where polyelectrolyte chains adsorbing on the surface adhere because of electrostatic attractions, and that is the only driving force for adsorption. So a lot of systems you might look at also have a chemical component of the driving force for adsorption, and that seems to be absent as best as we can see in this system. The chemistry is polydimethylamino ethyl methacrylate. So what happens is the chain becomes positively charged when that amino group becomes protonated. And about 2 years. So this chain can become protonated, and the chemists will refer to this as a weak polycation because its charge density along the backbone is pH dependent. The silica surface, its charge density is also pH dependent, and so while it's a strongly acidic surface from sort of a catalysis community point of view, it's still a weak acid from a physics point of view because its charge density also varies with pH. So the thing that was interesting about this system for us is that we can study its behavior by controlling pH. We can regulate the relative spacing of charge along the backbone chain relative to that on the surface, and so that's where the interesting physics comes in. Okay, so we want it to be quantitative in characterizing these charge densities, and so one does a number of painful titrations to make this happen, and this is Yang Wuxin's work. The blue line here is looking at the silica surface charge density as a function of pH on the right axis, and then on the left axis, and in red, our titration data summarized for the polymer at two different concentrations in free solution. So what you're looking at here is just characterization data of the polymer solution by itself and then of the surface by itself before we put the two together and let adsorption proceed. And then the second kind of experiment we've done is electrophoretic mobility, which gives you a sort of a net charge on the particle with its adsorbed polymer, but the charge you measure is that inside a shear plane, so there are free ions from the chemical perspective, but from the hydrodynamic perspective, they're associated with the particle. So you don't get quite the same information from these two kinds of experiments, and you have to be careful in putting it all together. When you do the arithmetic after all the titrations, you sort of come to a conclusion that's summarized by these cartoons. And here this characterization data is done for a low molecular weight sample, about 2,300 in molecular weight. So we've sort of scribbled these oligomeric chains in here roughly the size that they would be on a grid that's 5 by 5 nanometers. And we've tried to represent the charges as well. So before the adsorption occurs, there are four underlying negative surface charges at these conditions. And when the polymer adsorbs, a couple of things happen. So let me go over this in a little bit more detail. The adsorbing chain could have, at its particular molecular weight, it's 15 oligomers, so it could hold 15 underlying positive charges at the lowest pH. However, those charges would be too close together, and you would run into smaller than the Burum length, and so counterions would condense starting around the pH of 7 to relieve the underlying charge of the backbone. So the cartoon here showing, in this case, 5 charges along the backbone is the net charge after the negative counterions are associated somehow with the backbone. And so there are negative counterions not shown in the cartoon because of crowding that would also be part of this picture. Okay, so what we were looking for when we started doing these characterization studies was we wanted to be able to be quantitative in characterizing the release of counterions on adsorption, because it's the release of counterions that are thought to be the entropy gain from that, which is thought to be a primary driving force for polymer adsorption. And so this chain here might have, five bound counterions, and the question is, do those release? Can we detect them being released when the adsorption occurs? And the answer is, well, no. In fact, they don't. When the adsorption occurs, what we observe from the titration data is that we actually have positive charge being kicked out from the surface, and the cartoon is showing the situation for the point of zero charge from the electrokinetic experiment. So we're not looking at a saturated surface, we're looking at a surface where the complex with the adsorbed polymer and the surface is net zero charge. And so the way you can sort of close the charge balance and explain this kicking out of the positive charge is that we say we've lost 2 sodium ions, which were loosely associated with the particle in the hydrodynamic sense inside the shear plane. Those get moved to outside the shear plane when the polymer adsorbs. That would seem to be perhaps the first way to lose positive charge. And then secondly, we imagine that there's some additional ionization of the underlying silica so that about 4 protons are released from the surface when 1.5 chains adsorb in this 5x5 spot. So we don't see release of the negative counterions from the positive polymer. What we see is release of positive charge and the ions associated with the surface instead. The chains are isolated in this case when it's an oligomer. You have about 1 chain adsorbing per each charge site by the time you go up to saturation. And the energy of adsorption is going to reflect more than just the one positive-negative attraction, because you have these additional negative charges underneath the chain, so that's going to increase the binding energy as well. Okay, so that's the situation at pH 6. If you have low molecular weight chains, they tend to be isolated, one adsorbing on each charge. And as you increase the pH, you're moving to a situation where the silica's native surface charge is more dense and the protonation of the polymer is less. And in fact, by the time you're up to pH 8, you don't have any counterions bound, we don't believe, to the polymer even before adsorption occurs, because the native spacing of the protons is below the Burum length, and so you wouldn't see any of that. And when the adsorption occurs at pH 8, we could explain the loss of positive charge from the interface completely by releasing the sodium ions from within the hydrodynamic layer of the surface, and so we don't really have to have any more surface chemistry going on. The surface already has sufficient negative charge, and there's no more ionization induced by the adsorption process. So this is sort of just the general scenario of what's going on with this system. As you change pH, you move to a case where there's a lot of charge on the polymer to a case where the charge on the polymer becomes more sparse and the charge on the surface is increasing.
Can you explain again how you detect which experiment it is that tells you what charge leaves the surface?
Okay, it's a bunch of niggling arithmetic, basically. You know the initial condition of the surface here from the electrokinetic measurements of the bare silica, so you know that there are 4 underlying charges. You also have titrated the bare silica at that pH, so you know the chemical amount of bare charge present, and the surface charge you get from the titration is going to be stronger by about a factor of 2 relative to the surface charge you get from the electrokinetic experiment. And so the way to explain that discrepancy is by saying, well, there are counter ions, sodium in this case, inside the hydrodynamic shear plane as the particle moves in the electric field.
Is that the shear inside the Debye length?
Well, I mean, the Debye length is not quite the distance of the shear plane. I couldn't tell you exactly what it is off the top of my head. But, you know, it's the thing that determines the zeta potential as opposed to the surface charge.
Is the shear plane the distance, sort of the effective position of the no-slip?
Yeah, exactly. So there have to be positive charge inside there, because the net charge you measure from a particle moving in a field is lower than the charge you measure just by doing a chemical titration. And that's standard. I mean, everyone sees that. So our numbers agree with the literature there. So you know that initial condition. You know that there are 4 underlying charges and there are 2 sodium on that surface or associated with the surface before the adsorption starts. Okay, then at a particular pH, you measure this electrokinetic mobility for different adsorbed amounts, and you find a zero mobility position at a particular coverage, so you know that the net charge on the surface has to be 0 for that. Okay, so you know how much polymer is there, you know what, and you know basically what the total charge of that situation is. And then you go about trying to explain it. In this case, positive charge has to be kicked out during the adsorption process to close that math. Okay? Okay, so that's sort of the nanoscale chemistry. Then when you look at how this then affects the coverage, here are some adsorption isotherms. And now I'm going to switch systems on you slightly and show you the polymer adsorption behavior. We would have loved to have been able to do this characterization on the previous slide using this polymer, but you get flocculation and you can't do the electrokinetic mobility when you move up to these higher molecular weights due to bridging flocculation. So we use the lower molecular weight to do that characterization, but we don't imagine that the physics would really be any different here. The polymers also, by the way, are narrow molecular weight standards, which polydispersity is around 1.1. Okay, so the adsorption isotherms, and here with the polymer concentration shown on a log scale, are relatively flat, which is not really a surprise, except for when you get up to pH 6 and then you see sort of a Langmuirian shape on a log scale, which is indicative of actually a weaker binding. And when you look at the coverage as a function of pH, you see it goes through these maxima at pH is between 8 and 10, depending on the exact concentration. As you go in the limit of high pH, you're moving in the limit of having zero charge on the polymer chain. Now, the polymer is still completely soluble in water, so it's not crashing out the way something like polystyrene sulfonate would if you moved in the limit of zero charge. So this is still a good solution, but it's not adsorbing to the particle anymore just because it's got no charge on it. If you go in the other direction towards the point of zero charge of the silica, you see the polymer still binds, and there's a reason for that. Silica has a number of different kinds of silanols on its surface, and these dissociate with different pKa's. So when you're at the point of zero net charge for the silica, you actually have positively charged groups and negatively charged groups, and the polymer seems to be able to find the negatively charged groups and adsorb to it, so you don't see vanishing coverage in this limit. But what's worth noting as you go in the direction of low polymer charge and high surface charge, high pH, we've done some NMR experiments, and I didn't bring the data with us, but we do a solvent relaxation experiment that characterizes the amount of bound trains for different adsorption scenarios. And when you're over here in this regime, the polymer tends to adsorb flat with no loops or tails. And as you approach this limit where the polymer is becoming weakly charged and ultimately not having any charge on it at all, the layer gets fluffy just before it disengages from the surface. And so that's not a surprise. You have a flat layer here and sort of a fluffy layer here, and then no layer here. Okay, so so far, what I've shown you are our data in what we call the low salt limit, about 0.026 molar ionic strength, which is actually a quite modestly high ionic strength as far as things go when you look at the Debye length. But we have to have always buffering ions, otherwise we can't control the pH. So we can't just take all the ions out, otherwise we lose our ability to control the system. But if we wanted to look at an ionic strength effect, we do it by adding more salt. So we can't go in the limit of zero ionic strength. What I've shown you was as low as we could go. Now we can look at what happens as one adds salt. And I'm showing you data here for some two pHs that are very interesting, because you're going in the direction of high pH here as you're going towards weak adsorption. Here you're sort of around the maximum of the adsorption, or just a little bit past it. Okay, so at pH 7, as you increase, let me change slides. Here, let's go to the log scale on ionic strength, because it just shows a little bit more. As you go in the, at pH 7, as you go in the direction of increasing salt, you really only see a very mild effect of salt on the coverage. If you get down to nitpicking the details, if you go from the lowest to sort of an intermediate ionic strength shown here, you do increase the coverage a little bit, and that's because the chain is substantially charged here with about five charges per each segment of 2,000 molecular weight, as I sort of put in what I know about those characterization experiments. And so there's substantial repulsion between the segments of positive charges on the surface. And as you add salt, that becomes screened a little bit, so you can get a little bit increase in coverage. So that in there, the salt helps the adsorption to proceed. And then not too much happens. You see a slight deleterious effect of the salt on the coverage as you go further out. But if you drop now to pH 9, the salt has this very dramatic effect. You still see at low salt concentrations the fact that as you screen the electrostatic interactions, you can fit a little bit more on the surface. But then beyond that, salt competes with the chains for adsorption, and so you can completely eliminate adsorption by having a modest amount of salt. I mean, we're still not, you know, beyond one molar here. So this sort of desorption transition happens around order 0.1 molar salt. And so that's sort of an interesting situation. We were moving in the direction of having starting to not have enough charge on the polymer to have any adsorption. And now we see that in that limit, we have an effect of salt that can, we can really tune the adsorption strength. Okay, so.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I didn't understand probably from the beginning. As you increase ionic strength, is the you losing charge on the polymer, is it because it's being screened?
No. The ionic strength doesn't really have any first order effect of the charge on the polymer. As you increase the ionic strength in this regime, you're changing the Debye length, and so you're screening the repulsions between neighboring positive charges.
Or it's the pH that changes.
When you increase the pH, the positive charge density along the backbone decreases. When you're above about pH 8, you don't even have any counterions associated with the chain.
And the other question I had is if the polymer is not charged, are there kind of high order effects that make it absorb on the charged surface, like dipole or interaction?
No. There's no chemical interaction, whether you call that van der Waals or dipole. It doesn't absorb.
Well, I'm thinking more nothing dynamic, but if you have a dielectric particle, you can induce a dipole.
It doesn't adsorb once you take the charge off the chain. Okay, that's the observation. And so, yeah, those effects would be very weak. I mean, we have great sensitivity with these techniques, and I'll talk about the techniques in a minute. We can measure it down to 0.01, sometimes 0.05 milligrams per square meter, which is really quite low on the grand scheme of things. And I suppose if something were there, we would see it. But if you put in solvent, it comes right off. So it's not, it may just be residing near the surface and touching the surface a greater fraction of the time than it's, you know, free in solution, but I really wouldn't call it an adsorbed state in the classical sense that people use the word.
Yeah, so can you give some sense about what these coverages mean in terms of
I've been drawing the cartoons to sort of help you see.
Yeah, but for the polymer, you have in a 5-nanometer square region there, you draw one polymer. But I mean, when you said before about this fluffy layer, is it anywhere close to brush-like?
No, I wouldn't say that.
It's still isolated chain.
Yeah, we've. When you get up, most polymer layers that people use in industry for colloidal stabilization have about 1 milligram per square meter if it's homopolymer adsorption. And when you have brushes, you could see up to 10 milligrams per square meter. For instance, a lamellae, let me on an unrelated problem, but one that I've done a calculation on recently, so I know what I'm talking about. If you have something that's a brush with just 3 blobs in it, if this were PEO, you would have a contribution of about 1.75 milligrams per meter squared. Okay, that's our vesicles. That's the PEO part of one side of a vesicle. It's just barely starting to be a brush. It's only got 3 blobs in it. Okay, so
it's about an order of magnitude below that.
Yeah.
Level.
Okay, so for most of this, it's the coverages are low, and that's a point that we'll be talking about some more. Okay, any other sort of questions about what the system looks like? All right. Okay, so that's a system we're studying, and we're particularly interested in the dynamics as you loosen up the adsorption by having the competition with the ions. I'll come back to that one. So changing gears a little bit and to review some of the questions that one might ask in general about polymer adsorption and how people typically think about polymer adsorption. When one does polymer adsorption, the reason why it's of such technological use is because things stay stuck to the surface. So if a system is going to adsorb at all, typically you can't wash the chains off the surface in free solution, but the observation is that a physiadsorbed layer is still a dynamic entity, and so you can have exchange of chains from between free solution and those adsorbed to the surface. And while desorption itself can be excruciatingly slow, the self-exchange between free and adsorbed-like chains can be experimentally accessible. And it was Degen who first put forth the explanation that the energy cost to desorb a chain from an interface to a solvent could be as much as 100 kT, because you could have many segment surface contacts, 50 to 100 of these per chain, and each one costing about a kT. You would have to pay about 50 to 100 kT to remove an entire chain, and so equilibrium just isn't going to favor that. However, the exchange process essentially has a different kinetic energy barrier, because as you bring chains from the bulk solution to the interface, well, the net energy cost to desorb this chain and displace it is the same. The invading chain can trade places a few train segments at a time, and so the energy barrier is reduced substantially, and you have a cost of about 5 or 10 kT, depending on the length of the train that has to be disengaged as the trading of places happen. And so,
assuming low coverage or something?
No, not assuming low coverage. This is just sort of a general explanation taking place. So this is sort of a cartoon that I've drawn of what these adsorbed layers look like, where the situation is the polymer is made of tails, loops, and trains. So this is the generic classical adsorbed layer. And I've drawn the cartoon with the chains sort of unentangled so you can see, you know, what each looks like, but they'd be, you know, packed in two dimensions, entangled in two dimensions closer into each other.
So I guess I just worried for this mechanism, we need to have the other chain get close to the surface.
Yeah.
And you're saying you can do that even for, in the brush limit?
If it were a dense brush, no.
Well, for a dense brush, no. I mean, Milner has calculated the energy cost based on, I think it was something Leibler did previously, to bring a chain through sort of this osmotic barrier of a brush and then have it...
Which would be very slow. But you're saying you're well away from that regime?
Yeah, well, a brush, again, would be extended, bing, 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 you know, a factor of 10 for 10 blobs out each one of... This distance is about the radius of gyration of the polymer itself. Okay, so, you know, let me qualify that. There's other piece of information that is known about these adsorbed layers is these tail regions that I've drawn here, though hydrodynamically significant, are really quite dilute in terms of their volume fraction. Okay, so by the time you're 5 nanometers out, your volume fraction has decreased to 1% of what it was closer in. So thermodynamically, you can at least get to the loop layer. So this thing can be quite close to the surface within a few nanometers before it really starts feeling any repulsion.
I see.
Okay.
During the exchange process, you have dynamic traps due to entanglements of red and black.
Exactly.
And then it will be very slowly.
Right. I'm going to show you data addressing all this stuff. But the take-home point from this slide that I want you to remember is that people have this conception that desorption is always very slow, and exchange, while laggy in its execution, is accessible. Okay, and this is the reason put forth by Degen. And Granik has studied this for non-ionic systems, and we've taken a look at it. So again, to give you a gut feel, and I might at the end come back to this if we have time, this is polyethylene oxide, a more classic system, non-ionic, adsorbing on silica. It's a non-ionic chain adsorbing on to silica, where the ether groups of the PEO backbone have hydrogen bonding with the non-dissociated surface silanols, about 1 kT. For each segment surface contact. And what you see here is an adsorption trace, and then solvent is put in, phosphate buffer, and this is the desorption part. I mean, there's nothing going on. The layer retains itself. And I don't know that this is real. You get a little bit of instrumental drift that, you know, gives you some variation from run to run, but it's essentially flat. There's no desorption going on, and you contrast that to a self-exchange process where you adsorb a layer of fluorescently tagged chains, and then you challenge them with unlabeled chains, and off the original layer comes, and you can do the experiment in reverse and see the trading places of chains. So you can, you know, see that over a time scale of minutes, this trading of places happens where nothing goes on in the desorption, and this is sort of the standard behavior that people see, and this is the kind of thing Degen was looking at when he put forth that explanation. Okay, so we go back and look at now what happens with the polyelectrolyte layers. And I'll tell you the answer because you'll find it rather dull to look at for these different regimes. When you're here at pH 7 and you do an adsorbed layer and then you add solvent also at pH 7 in the same ionic strain aqueous solution, you really don't see any desorption going on. So the layer is retained. Okay. It's only when you get down into this regime that things start look interesting. And so the first thing that we see here are the desorption kinetics, and I've plotted them sort of on a real and renormalized scale, and it's sort of standard practice when you do these dynamics to do them on a renormalized scale, but I think the real scale is necessary here to also sort of remind you that as you go and add salt, you're really decreasing the initial coverage even before you start trying to wash it off the surface. So in each of these runs, we've put down an adsorbed layer at pH 9.6 and the ionic strength shown. And so this black set of data here is the lowest ionic strength we could access because of the buffer present. And you do see substantial desorption at this, by the time you're up to this pH, compared to, for instance, the polyethylene oxide system, which had really sort of flat behavior. And as you repeat the experiment at higher ionic strength, you desorb more quickly. And it's worth pointing out that the ionic strength doesn't change from the adsorption part of the run to the desorption part of the run. So the initial coverage is lower because we had a higher salt concentration initially, and that point is sort of lost when you look at the normalized version here, which helps you see the kinetic constants. I don't want to say too much about the shoulders here. We're looking at different batches of our sample at this point because I'm not convinced that that's a real feature. The data that we've gotten with three other batches seem to indicate that that can be made to go away depending on how we futz with our purification after labeling the polymer. Okay, so that's the desorption kinetics. So the question is then if you inject unlabeled chains, this is a fluorescence technique, can you knock the initially adsorbed chains off the surface more quickly due to a self-exchange process? And I'll show you data first for self-exchange comparing this desorption pink curve here, which is at 0.09 molar, and the 0.09 molar data are roughly, you know, here. Okay, so the point is that the desorption, if you look at short times or at the whole run, the desorption and the self-exchange data are beautifully superposable and reproducible, and you really can't say that there's any quantitative difference in kinetics, let alone a qualitative difference in kinetics. So this is a, you know, real surprise to us. It's a dramatically different behavior than what people generally report for self-exchange versus desorption kinetics. And it seems to hold true over the full range of ionic strengths that we looked at. As you go from the case where you have substantial adsorption in the sort of low ionic strength limit and you add salt, you're decreasing the coverage. But again, the self-exchange and the desorption traces are quantitatively identical to each other. So the conclusion here is that it's the total disengagement of the entire chain, which is 30,000 molecular weight, that's got to be the energy barrier, because you don't get any help from having another chain standing by to take its place. So that's got to be the control, rate controlling step in this process. And for the 0.09 molar, which is just sort of a nice middle of the road condition to examine further, we've also tried to do self-exchange at really high concentrations to see if we increase the free solution concentration of the challenging chains as high as we could and still have a manageable experiment. We still, as we change the concentration, we still see no effect of the free solution chains. Okay, so it's totally controlled at the surface.
How do you, what initiates this? You have some kind of, you dump some salt?
Oh,
change in ion
kinetics. Let me show you, I skipped over the experimental detail, because there's so many of them, I didn't want to detract from the point. But what we're doing here, we have two experiments in my lab. One is total internal reflection fluorescence, and the other is near Brewster optical reflectivity. This experiment sees the surface coverage of fluorescently tagged chains, and this technique sees the total mass on a surface. It's sort of a poor woman's ellipsometry. And both of these are in a planar geometry. So we have a slit shear flow cell over the surface, and we know the mass transfer coefficient in that cell. And we are very careful about interpreting the data in terms of mass transport and versus true surface kinetics. The other thing is when you have this flow cell, you're continually flowing solvent, fresh solvent over the surface, then you turn a valve over and you inject the polymer solution, and so there's significance to the adsorption and desorption kinetics as well. that are extremely well characterized. Okay.
So
the surface is wet, and we're pumping through this chamber, and we're looking at a part of the surface with the laser.
Right.
Okay.
So, but you start in a state where polymer wants to absorb to the surface, and then you change something. So what is
it? So we initially have solvent, a salt solution, pH buffered salt solution flowing over the surface. We turn a valve over, and now we have the same salt solution, the same buffering ions present, and polymer coils present. The adsorption proceeds. Then we turn the valve back over, we go back to the initial solution. So all we're doing is taking the polymer chains in and out of the free solution while continually replenishing the ionic species in free solution. Okay. Okay, so that you saw the desorption and self-exchange kinetics are identical, and if you try to look at what the form is for either of those, well, it seems like it's sort of bi-exponential, with most of the kinetics dominated by a long single exponential decay. That's markedly different from what Granik reports and what we see for non-ionic systems. Those other systems tend to be stretched exponential in their behavior. So this is single exponential, or maybe you can pick up a second short time process here that actually relates to the shoulder, so we're not saying too much about that. So you can get time constants off of this if you like, but I think it's just interesting that it is single exponential, because you don't see that too much. But again, it is indicative of a process that's not really cooperative between neighboring chains. It's sort of one kinetic slow event. And the more we thought about this, the more we just sort of slapped ourselves in the head. It puzzled us. We've been looking at these data for a very long time and wondering, you know, whether or not we had done the experiments correctly. But we simply think the underlying physics in this case is that the chains are really not entangled on the surface. They're behaving individually, and because the surface coverage is so low, this is why desorption is dominating. Okay, so you're not really seeing an entangled surface. Yeah.
Do you have any way to look at the on-off rate of chains adsorbed to the surface in the presence of just the solvent, so during the so-called desorption process?
Like a frequency of? Not really. I mean, we're going to go back and interpret these in terms of sort of a net desorption constant, because I think that's fair to do now that we have come to the conclusion that, yeah, this is non-cooperative. But
it could be that the desorption process is a little bit like your exchange process, that sort of self-exchange.
Right, exactly. So what I want to do is sort of summarize this and then make comparison with the non-ionic case. Because now that we're proposing that it's surface coverage, in addition to these two regimes of polymer charge, surface coverage becomes the interesting parameter that we want to look at. So what I've shown you so far is that the two regimes we've looked at is one where the surface charge is much denser than the charge along the polymer backbone. As you increase the salt concentration, you can really completely shut out the polymer adsorption. Okay, and as you go in that limit with modest polymer charge, you tend to have loopy layers, which start to look a little bit like homopolymer adsorption. And then we see all these details. But in the opposite extreme, where the polymer charge is greater than the surface charge, and you have, again, this underlying ionization of the surface as well, increasing the salt screens the self-repulsion of the adsorbing chains, thereby increasing the coverage, and you have flat layers and really no dynamics to even look at.
Can I just look at the thermodynamics of adsorption? For a single molecule, I expect adsorbed coverage to just be strictly linear and concentrated solution concentration. Do you know if that's the case?
No, it isn't. When we're for instance, in these regimes here, pH 6 and 7. Now this, again, the cartoon was for the low molecular weight oligomer. okay? But if in each one of these oligomers is about 2,500, so if you strung enough of them together or connected them, you still would tend to see the chains not really being entangled, right? So you, what you're saying might still hold, having this linear.
They wouldn't overlap.
They wouldn't overlap. So I can sort of reiterate what you said. You expect this linear relationship between the coverage and the free solution concentration. Would you indeed expect that in a condition like this, based on what you just said?
If the surface coverage is so low that the chains are not interacting on the surface.
Okay, right. Okay, so you know, a situation like this where the chains are seeing the surface charges are far enough apart that that's what's drawing the adsorption. Then when you look at the adsorption isotherms, no, the adsorption isotherms are flat. Okay, so it's still a very tight binding kind of adsorption isotherm because this is a log scale here. Okay, so you don't see this sort of front end of a Langmuir isotherm happening here. So Langmuir. Okay, so in that, I put the other slide up because in the limit of low pH, I thought was the regime that you were talking about. Here's something like pH 7 or pH 6, which is not shown, but gives the same behavior.
You got this interesting behavior
at the higher pHs. That's right. So now you're moving into a fluffier layer, but the coverage is higher before it drops off. So when you're sort of here, you get the flat isotherms. The chains are isolated, but the isotherms are extremely flat. When you're here, the layers are fluffy, but the chains are not as densely charged. Okay, so this increase in the coverage here is really because the layer is getting fluffy. So here's what a layer of trains looks like. It's got a coverage somewhere in here, and then when you start putting more on the surface, you get these loops and tails, and the coverage goes up with free solution concentration.
Okay. So in any case, it's not as simple as simply having very weakly adsorbed polymers. The thermodynamics is still complicated.
I think so. Okay. So let me. Change folders then. We spent a lot of time looking at the polyethylene oxide system. And we had. Here we go. A nice little segment of work where we tried to understand the mechanism for self-exchange here. And the reason why I bring it up is, again, because I'm starting to believe that the surface coverage was incredibly important to the mechanism for the other case, although there's still substantial differences. So here you have a layer that at saturation would tend to be made more classically of tails, loops, and trains. And if you try to understand, you know, what's controlling the dynamics of this, one typically sees in this case not single exponential behavior for the self-exchange, but stretched exponential behavior for the self-exchange. I try to ask myself, well, what's the rate controlling step to this process, which actually has several pieces to it, and as I think you were perhaps alluding to, well, you have a fluffy layer, and isn't there some sort of energy barrier to the penetration of chains to that layer? With the electrostatic situation, if you have a fluffy layer, it's the particularly charged ones that are down, and so you have just regular chains out, so at least you don't have an electrostatic repulsion contributing to it. Here with polyethylene oxide, the coverages approach half a milligram per square meter at saturation, and you could have, and we expect to have, some repulsion here at the tails, so that could be a rate controlling step, and then once the chain does get into the layer, and there are trading places of segments in the train layer, the release of trains of the initially adsorbed chains could be dynamically important, and then of course everything has to happen in reverse for a chain to completely disengage and get out. So the question is, you know, which of these steps is going to be important? So here, we did an experiment that varied the surface coverage prior to the self-exchange, trying to look at whether or not entanglements would be important or the release of segment surface contacts would be important. And so the experimental scheme is that we adsorb on one hand sort of a starved layer. Again, using the controlled mass transport, we can control the exposure time of the surface very precisely and put down an initial layer that has only a milligram, 0.1 milligrams per square meter as opposed to a full milligram per square meter. In this case, the polyethylene oxide doesn't desorb when you put solvent in, and so if you age the layer in the presence of solvent, these chains presumably relax and give you a surface made mostly of trains unless the coverage is higher. If you saturate the surface and then relax it, you'll get tails, loops, and trains. And so then we want to compare the behavior if you challenge the adsorbed layer with unlabeled chains in this case. And the question is whether or not this sort of flat starved layer can be removed more quickly than the layer that's relaxed in tails, loops, and chains. Now, if you think back to the Degen argument, this layer here would have more segment surface contacts per chain. And so if that were the rate controlling step, this should be more slow. However, if it's some sort of entanglement or osmotic repulsion effect, then this should be more slow, right? Okay, so the answer turns out to be that more crowded surfaces are slower to undergo self-exchange. Okay, so here are three runs with different amounts of initially adsorbed polyethylene oxide, and then they're aged for a reasonable amount of time and then challenged with the unlabeled chains. And it's not obvious when you just look at the raw self-exchange or displacement data, but if you look at the normalized data, you can see the pink run here, which is associated with the starved layer, has a intrinsically faster removal from the surface than the chains that were incubated or aged in a more crowded condition. Okay, so that's one piece of the puzzle. Although with the polyethylene oxide, there's sort of a trick that makes...
Sorry, was it still single expansion? The relaxation was single expansion?
The relaxation here is different for depending on which run you're looking at. So this part here is stretched exponential as you approach a crowded layer, but this part here I wouldn't say is stretched exponential or single exponential. It's got an initial fast process, which is really mass transport limited and depends on what the challenging concentration is and how fast you're flowing over the layer, and then it's got a slower tail here, and so because this part is so short, I would hesitate to try and fit it to a single exponential.
So
the functional dependence really depends on the surface coverage.
The slowest one is certainly not single exponential.
No, the slowest one is stretched exponential.
But the initial slope, so, I mean, to the extent that you can get that, the same.
The initial... Perhaps. Okay. Yeah, good point. I hadn't thought about that. We've done for different aging times and for some other variables a close analysis of what affects the initial slope. So I'm sitting here thinking about that. That's an important point that you make. That really hadn't thought about that. The thing is, with polyethylene oxide, when you do the challenge experiment, and this is looking at reflectometry, so now you're looking at total mass as opposed to a labeled population. If you compare the same runs, here is a saturated layer, then here the solvent is introduced, it ages with time, and then self-exchange happens at the arrow, the unlabeled chains are introduced, you don't see any change in coverage, because self-exchange is occurring. If you do it with the starved layer here, you start to do the adsorption, you put in solvent, you age the layer, those chains stay on the surface while you age them, and then when you inject the unlabeled chains to do the self-exchange, the first thing that happens is the surface saturates very quickly. It saturates an instant before the original chains on the surface start coming off. Okay, so that has to happen because here, the surface is starved and it has greater capacity. And if you had exposed it for the full amount of time, you would have saturated the surface. So of course, when you put the polymer solution back in, it will adsorb. What's interesting in this case is that this relaxation of the chains on the surface doesn't seem to affect the later coverage. If you do this with proteins, for instance, and you age an unsaturated layer, proteins denature on the surface. When you put the original solution back in, you get some lower coverage. But in this case, the originally adsorbed chains don't affect the equilibrium, even though they're certainly relaxing on the surface, and you could see that by NMR. So this sort of complicates how one has to be careful in interpreting things. But again, this self-exchange was the one that happened the most quickly. So the originally adsorbed chains don't prohibit the adsorption of the late arriving chains, and they don't prohibit self-exchange. Okay, so this is the last slide. What we did was summarize the effects of coverage and aging time, coverage and molecular weight together, looking to see if we saw any evidence for entanglements. And we have this for four different samples. So what you're looking at then is the amount of starving or the coverage and different molecular weights and a characteristic time describing the self-exchange. Now, as was pointed out earlier, these self-exchange traces, they're all sort of different mathematical functionality. So there's not any one fitting parameter that you might want to choose to characterize the self-exchange. So the question is, if you want to compare these runs and summarize things, how do you make the comparison? Well, we simply said, let's just ask the question, how long does it take to get to 50% of the original coverage? So we said, let's define a tau 50, because we can't use a tau for a stretched exponential, compare it to a two-part self-exchange process. So the question is, how do we do that? So it's a tau 50, time to remove 50% of the originally adsorbed chains. And how does tau 50 then depend on surface coverage and molecular weight? Well, it seems that there's no effect of molecular weight at low surface coverages at all. And in fact, at most surface coverages, you really have to go up to high molecular weights and high surface coverages before you see the process become slow. Okay, so this lack of a molecular weight dependence for samples ranging from about 10,000 to 112,000, and even the 460,000 molecular weight, it is really about a factor of two slower here. So the 460,000 molecular weight sample is slower than the others, but you don't see an effective molecular weight in this regime. Now, in the bulk for polyethylene oxide, the entanglement molecular weight is about 2,000. That's for a concentrated system. And if you imagine that an adsorbed layer has maybe a 20% volume fraction, then if the entanglement molecular weight scales is the volume fraction to the 4/3 or minus 4/3 power, you get an expected entanglement molecular weight cutoff somewhere in here, 20,000-30,000, something like that. So you would still expect for a concentrated polymer solution that chains of 112,000 molecular weight would be entangled, and we really don't see evidence for that. Their self-exchange behavior is the same as the lower molecular weight material, as best as we can see. So we're not really seeing an entanglement kind of process here responsible for the slowing down, except perhaps at the highest molecular weights. But the take-home point is, at least in a qualitative sense, you really do have to have a crowded surface in order to see slowing down. But still, in all these cases, one big difference between the polyethylene oxide and the charge system is that here the desorption is always kinetically different than the self-exchange. Okay.
So the lack of entanglement, I mean, this is time on hours, 20 hours or...
Yeah.
So it's basically just telling us that whatever entanglement constraints there are to things moving around on the surface are just happening on a shorter time scale.
Well, if there are entanglements occurring, we can't think about them the same way as we would about bulk entanglements, because bulk entanglements tell you there should be a certain molecular weight dependence to a terminal relaxation.
Well, but here it's a loop. A loop has a constant...
There's a pin.
Yeah, it's a number of loops, but each loop is constant length. So
that's right. That's exactly right. So if it's a pinning rather than a true melt-type entanglement, then those, you don't have to pull the whole chain out. You can have one loop sort of hop over the next loop, and so the molecular weight dependence, if that's what's going on, is lost. But the other factor that we really can't quite neglect is we go back and say, what is the rate limiting step? The last point to mention here is that you get up to about 0.2, 0.3 milligrams per square meter on these starved surfaces, and the chains are still absorbed relatively flat, and you only see loops and tails at higher coverages. So if you do an NMR solvent relaxation study, which doesn't tell you the extent of the loops and tails, and I would hesitate to use a hydrodynamic type measure to characterize the loops and tails for this kind of study, the loops and tails are really developing out here, and it's the highest molecular weight samples that can contribute the loops and tails. So at this point, we haven't really been able to decouple those two mechanisms, some sort of dynamic surface process and the penetration of chains into the layer. Okay, so I think one can't throw that argument out yet. We're sort of gearing up at UMass to do some lateral diffusion experiments where the loopy layer and penetration through it won't be so much of an issue. Okay, but I still like this observation that the molecular weight dependence is lost, and so perhaps in these dynamics is information about the lifetime of loops, and you don't need to have the loops released sequentially the way you would to have a chain reptate out of a tube. Okay, so that's my story.
Chain size is one thing, but if entanglements are present, you do expect strong dependence of the relaxation times on the loop size, and there's a vague relation between this, not so much to linear polymers, but to ring polymer belts.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think of your loop arrangement, your loops, you can rearrange it a bit like ring polymers. Then there's a strong scaling. It's not 3, it's 2.5.
I have some old polystyrene loops that Lou Fetters made in a refrigerator that I've been keeping my entire career for the right minute. Yeah. I don't know what's left of them. You know, they must be 20 years old now, but there they are. So his don't undergo any sort of degradation, unlike other people's.
I mean, your control of the loop size is essentially pH.
That's right. With the charge system, and that's what we were sort of hoping to look at, but we had this bizarre result that the desorption and the self-exchange kinetics were quantitatively identical.
So we would be looking at the charge system with the lateral diffusion measurements as well?
Sure.
That could tell you a lot.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, just following up on that level, how much of a range of loop size do you think you have your experiment span?
We mean, what do I have in the fridge?
No, not this.
The estimate would be distance between charges or something.
Let's look back at that picture.
So I get, do the dynamics strongly, do they correlate strongly with the group sizes that you deduce from?
The pH 9.6, the coverage is falling off very quickly, and we look to, and again, counter ion condensation is not an issue. Okay, so we're right here, the protonation on the polymer is extremely low. I would hesitate to, you know, make a distinction between one or two or three charges per chain based on the error in the titration, but it's that level that the chains adsorb. If they only have one or two charges on them, you can still get substantial adsorption, and the last of the adsorption sort of diminishes as you remove the chains from the surface. One thing that we have done is we've done comparisons of systems like this with data out here as you go in the limit of high pH for the 30,000 molecular weight and the 2,000 molecular weight system, and the 2,000 molecular weight system peels off much faster while the 30,000 is adsorbed. So, you know, that tells you that overall, for a particular mass of polymer, you have a certain amount of charges per chain, and with the 2,000 molecular weight system, as you start to lose, go from between 0 and 1, that's when you start losing the adsorption. That peels off first, and so you can still have maybe 5 or 6 or 7 charges per chain of the 30,000 system and still be up here. Okay, so it's really just a couple of charges per chain, and then it drops right off. So that's where we are.